You are listening to a Bible talk recorded at the 1982 Western Christadelphian Bible School at Manuka. This is the third class in a series given by Brother Bill Farrar on the subject, The First Coming of the Messiah.
We've got a lot of ground to cover today, so we're going to have to switch into high gear right at the start and proceed vigorously. A relatively large portion of the gospel records is given to a discussion of the trials of Jesus, and at the end of the class, we're going to suggest why that might be so. There were really two trials. They shouldn't really be called trials, because neither one was a trial in the true sense of the word. But there was one before the Jewish court and one before the Romans that had nothing to do one with the other, as we'll see. The first trial and the second trial were not related at all, as we shall see. In fact, the second trial finally ended up that Jesus was not on trial, but rather Pontius Pilate was on trial. The points we wish to discuss, firstly, are these. One, the immediate historical context. Two, the Jewish trial. Three, the Roman trial. Four, the reason for the detail relating to the trial. And fifthly, some conclusions. The immediate historical context was that as Jesus had gone around throughout his ministry, there had been from time to time those who wished to make him a king. Now, when Jesus therefore perceived that they would come and take him by force to make him a king, he departed again into a mountain himself alone. We come now to just shortly before the Passover, when the miracles of Jesus reached its zenith, or their zenith, in the resurrection of Lazarus from the dead. The people, therefore, that was with him when he called Lazarus out of his grave and raised him from the dead bear record. For this cause the people also met him, for they heard that he had done this miracle. The Pharisees, therefore, said among themselves, "Perceive how we prevail nothing? Behold, the world is gone after him." We now come up to the time of the Passover when Josephus records that there were up to 1 million Jews in the city, around the city of Jerusalem. The chief priests and Pharisees wanted to get rid of him lest he make some great proclamation at this particular feast. So they gathered together, and this is what they said. Then gathered the chief priests and the Pharisees to council and said, "What do we? For this man doeth many miracles. If we let him thus alone, all men will believe on him. And the Romans shall come and take away both our place and nation." And one of them, named Caiaphas, being the high priest that same year, said unto them, "Ye know nothing at all, nor consider that it is expedient for us that one man should die for the people, and that the whole nation perish not." Then from that day forth they took counsel together for to put him to death. Jesus, therefore, walked no more openly among the Jews, but went thence unto a country near to the wilderness, into a city called Ephraim, and there continued with his disciples. However, as the Passover got closer and closer, there was an expectation that he might do something. And the Jews' Passover was nigh at hand, and many went out of the country up to Jerusalem before the Passover to purify themselves. Then sought they for Jesus, and spake among themselves as they stood in the temple, "What think ye? That he will not come to the feast?" Now both the priests, chief priests and Pharisees had given a commandment that if any man knew where he might be, he should show it, that they might take him. So the people were looking for him in the temple, and the chief priests were looking for him to put him to death. However, the problem the chief priests had was that they really couldn't go and take him openly, first of all, because they feared what the people would do, but secondly, they had this problem. Then assembled together the chief priests and the scribes and the elders of the people under the palace of the high priest, who was called Caiaphas. And they consulted that they might take Jesus by subtlety and kill him. But they said, "Not on the feast day, lest there be an uproar among the people." Now the trouble was that the people, they had 1 million Jews, remember, gathered around the city of Jerusalem, and many of them were looking for Jesus, whether he would come up to the temple at this time. And they didn't want to take him on the feast day, because if they did, the law required that he be kept in prison at least 9 days over the week of the Passover. And if they had this great prophet, in jail over this period, they were afraid that the people, many of whom were very favorable towards Jesus, would cause a tremendous uproar, the very thing that they wanted to avoid. So they had a problem. They wanted to eliminate Jesus, but they couldn't go out publicly and seize him. First of all, they didn't know where he was. But secondly, they were afraid of what the people would do if they did so. Well, who played into their hands? None other than Judas Iscariot. Then one of the 12, called Judas Iscariot, went unto the chief priests and said unto them, "What will ye give me, and I will deliver him unto you?" And they covenanted with him for 30 pieces of silver. And from that time he sought opportunity to betray him. And I think understood there, Judas was seeking opportunity to betray him privately. Now, why did they want to kill Jesus? What were the motives for them wanting to kill him anyways? Well, I think there are several. We're only going to name three or four here. First of all, he saw through their hypocrisy and told them plainly that he did. You can't read Matthew 23 if you were a Pharisee listening to that discourse and be exactly pleased with what you heard. I mean, to be called what he called them is not exactly the way to win friends and influence people. He called a spade a spade. Secondly, they were clearly envious of his popularity. Envy. It says that Pilate knew that they delivered Jesus for envy. The whole world was going after him, the whole Jewish world, after the resurrection of Lazarus, and they didn't like it. The third reason was, they didn't really know what he was going to do. There was a real possibility that he could have started a political revolt at this Passover, which would have cost them their favored status with Rome. Fourthly, I don't know how important this was, but some of the rulers felt that he did his miracles by the power of Satan. Here is a case where false understanding had the most serious of consequences. And I think the last reason, and perhaps this was maybe the most important reason, if we look in the 8th chapter of John, here was a man who came saying, at the 24th verse of the 8th chapter, here's what he told people who were the rulers, who had the law, who had their whole code and so forth. Here is what he said unto them, "I say therefore unto you, that ye shall die in your sins, for if ye believe not, then I am he, ye shall die in your sins." In other words, if you don't believe me, you're going to die in your sins. And this was anathema to them. They had Moses and the law, and there was no way this peasant, whatever he was able to do from Nazareth, was going to tell them how religion, if you can put it that way, should be run. Now, I apologize that this came out so small, but you'll just have to bear with me. We just want to set basically a timeline here. Judas betrayed him, and they arrested him about midnight. From midnight to daybreak, that is about 6 hours. First of all, he was taken to Annas' residence, and then he was before Caiaphas and the Sanhedrin. Right at 6 o'clock in the morning, as the sun was coming up, they had a grand consultation of the chief priests, elders, scribes, and the whole council. And they had to decide what they were going to do with him at 6 o'clock in the morning. And what they decided to do, for reasons that we'll look at a little later, they decided to take him to Pilate. And what Pilate was doing up at 6 o'clock in the morning, I think we can also speculate a little bit. From 6 o'clock to 9 o'clock, 3 hours, he was before Pilate, then he went to Herod, then Herod sent him back to Pilate. From about 9 o'clock to noon, he was on his way to Calvary, where they actually crucified him. He hung on the cross from about noon to 3 o'clock in the afternoon and expired about that time. Well, what happened after they got Jesus, after Judas had betrayed him? Well, I'm going to read it here, but and then we're going to explain what was going on in this, what is called the trial, but it really wasn't a trial. It was something quite a bit different than a trial. Well, here's what happened. Jesus went forth with his disciples over the brook Kidron, where there was a garden, into the which he entered, and his disciples, and Judas also, which betrayed him, knew the place, for Jesus oft times resorted thither with his disciples. Judas then, having received the band of men and officers from the chief priests and Pharisees, cometh thither with lanterns and torches and weapons. And going down in the interest of time, we come to the point where they led him away to Annas first, for he was father-in-law to Caiaphas, which was the high priest that same year. Now Caiaphas was he which gave counsel to the Jews that it was expedient that one man should die for the people. We just want to jump over, because it isn't really that relevant to what we're talking about this morning, about Peter denying Jesus, over to the beginning of the trial. The high priest, Caiaphas, then asked Jesus of his disciples and his doctrine. Jesus answered him, I spake openly to the world. I ever taught in the synagogue and in the temple, whither the Jews always resort, and in secret have I said nothing. Why askest thou me? Ask them which heard me what I have said unto them. Behold, they know what I said. And when he had thus spoken, one of the officers which stood by struck Jesus with the palm of his hand, saying, Answerest thou the high priest so? Jesus answered him, If I have spoken evil, bear witness of the evil. But if well, why smitest thou me? Now at first sight, if we don't know the Jewish law, we might think that Jesus gave almost, and I want to be very careful, I'll use almost an offhand, or what we might almost term a smart aleck response. Why are you asking me? They heard me. But that really wasn't what he was saying at all, because one of the laws that comes out of the law of Moses and had been somewhat embellished by the Jews, a man could not be condemned on his own testimony. So they had no, you could not ask someone on trial in a Jewish courtroom for his own opinion, because he couldn't be condemned on his own words anyways. And Jesus was simply telling Caiaphas and the rest of the council here that, why are you asking me? You very well know that your own law says you can't condemn a witness on his own testimony. You have to have other witnesses. So that Jesus was very correct in what he said, and when they smashed him on the face for doing so, he rightly answered, If I have spoken evil, bear witness. But if well, why smitest thou me? In other words, what he was saying, I'm only doing what the law says. You cannot ask me and condemn me on my own testimony in a courtroom. You know it, and I know it. Well, what did they do? Now the chief priests and elders and all the council sought false witnesses. That's how fair the trial began. First of all, it's a judicial system, and the first thing they're seeking are false witnesses. They want witnesses, but they don't care if they're true or false, against Jesus to put him to death, but found none. Yea, though many false witnesses came, yet found they none. And at last came two false witnesses. So finally, they appear to have what they want. Two false witnesses. Now remember, by this time it's about 1:30 a.m. It's 1:30 in the morning. You've got a million people in the city of Jerusalem, many of whom are interested in this man who's now on trial. You've got the whole Sanhedrin there in the middle of the night, and now you come to present the case against this man. And the two false witnesses came and said, This fellow said, I am able to destroy the temple of God and to build it in 3 days. We heard him say, I will destroy this temple that is made with hands, and within 3 days I will build another made without hands. But neither did their witnesses agree together. And the high priest arose and said unto him, Answerest thou nothing? What is it which these witness against thee? But Jesus held his peace. Now do you see what was happening? It's 1:30 in the morning. He's got the high priest has got the Sanhedrin there. He's got the man before him that he wanted. And what happens? The witnesses don't agree. On a technicality, there is no case before the court. It's 2 o'clock in the morning now, say. And there's no case. The thing is breaking down right in front of the high priest, because he finally got two false witnesses. On the technicality that they did not agree, he couldn't accept their testimony. So there's no case. It's 2 o'clock in the morning. What are we going to do? Well, we'll see what the high priest did. But first of all, we want to just mention a couple of things. First of all, under Jewish law, when there was a capital case, and this was going to be a capital case because the charge they were trying to work up against Jesus was blasphemy, which would result in death. First of all, they could have no trial by night on a capital case. That was in their law. This was taking place in the middle of the night. So they were breaking their first rule right there. Secondly, any time there was a capital case before the court, that is, a case which could lead to the death penalty, It was a rule in Jewish law that they could not pass sentence on the same day of the trial. In other words, the people who were going to make the sentence had to go home and think about it overnight, and the next day, if there was going to be a capital, if the sentence finally was going to be death, there had to be at least a day between the giving of the evidence and the final condemnation. Now, we're just going to talk a little bit for a moment about witnesses, because even the Jewish trial here, they were concerned about witnesses. It's been suggested that Jesus was on trial once before, not in anywhere near as severe a sense as this, but it's in the 5th chapter of John, and at that time, he said of himself, "If I bear witness of myself," which the Jewish law itself said, "my witness is not true." So then he proceeded to give things that bore witness of him. He said, "There is another that beareth witness of me, and I know that the witness he witnesses of me is true." His first witness that testified of himself was John. The second witness that testified of himself were the works of the Father. The third witness of himself was the Father himself when he spoke to him at his baptism. And the fourth witness that Jesus brought forward was the Scriptures that testified of himself. Now, what happened next? Just keep that in mind about witnesses, because Jesus did bring up one of these witnesses in a moment. What happened was the high priest and the council were at their wits' end. That's what happened, because the witnesses that they needed to condemn Jesus did not agree. So what happened was that the judge, the man, now let's just visualize this in our system of justice, the judge who was there to adjudicate the case came down from behind the bench and became the prosecutor. He didn't like the way the case was going, so the judge, Caiaphas, became the prosecutor. And what did he do? He came down, when he saw there was no case before the court, he came down and he said, and the high priest answered and said unto him, "I adjure thee by the living God that thou tell us whether thou be the Christ, the Son of God." Now he had no conceivable right to do that. The judge, who's trying to make a decision, became the prosecutor. So he came down to Jesus, and when Jesus was given that, he had to reply. Jesus saith unto him, "Thou hast said, nevertheless I say unto you, hereafter ye shall see the Son of Man sitting on the right hand of power, coming in the clouds of heaven." Now the witness that he chose here was the Scripture that he had talked about earlier, taken from Daniel 7 here, where it says about the Son of Man coming in the clouds of heaven. Now the high priest, as soon as Jesus said that, the high priest said, rent his clothes, saying, "He has spoken blasphemy. What further need have we of witnesses?" Now we'll see how hypocritical that statement was. "Behold, now ye have heard his blasphemy. What think ye?" They answered and said, "He is guilty of death." Now it just so happens that on the charge of blasphemy under Jewish law, you couldn't do what he just did. When there was a charge of blasphemy, this is what had to be done. The judges sent all the people out of the court and asked the chief among the witnesses and said unto him, "Say expressly what thou heardest." And he says it, and the judges stand up upon their feet and rend their garments, and they may not mend them again. Now, Caiaphas didn't obey that at all. As soon as Jesus said what he said, he rent his garments. Now, you couldn't do that under Jewish law, because here is what the Jewish law said. First of all, when it comes to a need for witnesses, the following rules had to be observed. None of the Pharisaic rules governing the trial of cases of alleged blasphemy had been observed. You had to do what we just read there. And secondly, you had to wait a day before passing judgment if it was a capital case. Secondly, the court was trying the accused on the basis that he had committed an offense before he came into court. Now you see, what happened was they had Jesus there and there was no case. It's 2 o'clock in the morning and the witnesses have broken down. So in order to save the situation, Caiaphas the judge came down and became the prosecutor and made Jesus say, ask Jesus, tell us whether you are the Son of God. Now, when Jesus did this, the court was trying the accused on the basis of something he had committed an offense before he came into court and not for something said by the accused in court. this was all of a sudden a whole new law case, because Jesus had sent something in the courtroom, and by rights, a whole new date should have been set for a new trial based upon what had just happened. The third thing was that you could not condemn a man on the basis of what he said himself. You could not condemn a man on the basis of his own confession. So, what happened? Well, what happened was that... Oh, there's a fourth point we should make, and it's a very important point. Caiaphas said to Jesus, "Tell us, are you the Son of God?" And Jesus answered, "Yes, I am." They never investigated whether that claim was true. There was not even the faintest desire among them to say, well, now that he said he's the Son of God, let's look into the evidence and see whether he is. What happened? He rent his garments and said, "What further need have we of witnesses?" Which we have just seen under his own law. He needed all kinds of witnesses. "Behold, now ye have heard his blasphemy. What think ye?" They answered and said, "He is guilty of death." So then they, until the morning, they waited, and they mocked him and spit in his face and buffeted him and so forth. And in the morning, straightway in the morning, the chief priests held a consultation with the elders and scribes and the whole council and bound Jesus and carried him away to Pilate. Now it appears that there's a few things we should look into. First of all, Jesus did not really make a tremendous defense here. I think there are several reasons. First of all, it wasn't even a trial, it was a farce. But I think one of the reasons that he did not really make a tremendous defense was this. As soon as it was day, and the elders of the people and the chief priests and the scribes came together and led him into their council, saying, "Art thou the Christ? Tell us." And he said unto them, "If I do tell you, you will not believe. And if I also ask you, you will not answer me nor let me go. Hereafter shall the Son of Man sit on the right hand of the power of God." So I think Jesus, with his foreknowledge of what was to occur, he knew that whatever he said, he was not going to get a fair trial, and therefore did not argue the case strenuously at all. Now I think in fairness to some of the people that were at that evening event, not everyone agreed with what was going on. There was a man named Joseph, a counselor. He was a good man and a just. The same had not consented to the counsel indeed of them. But I think that it's just like a mob. Once the sort of the mob, the general feeling was that the man was worthy of death, there was nothing that the moderates, you might say, who would have asked that the rules of Jewish law be obeyed and so forth, they just weren't heard. So now we come to a simple review of the Jewish trial before at 6 o'clock in the morning they're going to take him over to Pilate. First of all, it was illegal. You couldn't have a trial like this in the middle of the night, and you had to wait to the next day to condemn a man anyways. The case broke down. They looked for false witnesses. Finally, they got two, but on the technicality that they did not agree, there was no case before the court. Caiaphas, who was the judge, suddenly came down and became the prosecutor. He adjured Jesus to tell them whether he was the Son of God, and when Jesus said, "Yes, in effect, I am the Son of God," Caiaphas rent his garments and said, "He is worthy of death." Now, it looks like they had a council, probably about 5:30 in the morning, to decide what they were going to do with Jesus, whether they were going to put him to death or whether they didn't want to bear that responsibility. And the net effect of their discussion was, "And the whole multitude of them arose and led him unto Pilate." Now, probably the reason for going to the Romans are probably these two. One, an illegal murder would have caused Caiaphas to lose his priesthood, which he held at the pleasure of Pilate. If there had been this famous individual illegally murdered, say, stoned early in the morning, which would have caused a big uproar with the Jewish community at that time, Caiaphas probably would have lost his high priesthood, which he didn't want to do. And secondly, the people were expecting the great prophet who went about doing good to claim the Messiahship at this Passover. To take the responsibility for his execution could bring down the people's wrath on their rulers. It would be much better if the Romans could be blamed for the execution of Jesus. So they take him to Pilate. Now we should know a couple of things about Pilate. Pilate and the Jews did not get along at all. Pilate had had three notable run-ins recorded by Josephus with the Jewish nation, and these are what they were. First, Caesar decided that he was going to put Caesar's images up in the city of Jerusalem. And what the Jews did to block that was they laid on the ground and exposed their throats and said that Pilate's forces would have to put every one of them to death before they would allow the images of Caesar to go up in Jerusalem. So Pilate backed down on that one. He was defeated. Secondly, Pilate took temple funds from the Jewish system of religion, took the money and made it into to make an aqueduct, a Roman aqueduct to carry water in a certain part of Jerusalem. In the uproar that followed that, several Jews were killed in the riot, and it caused a further tension between Pilate and the Jewish community. And thirdly, Jesus talks about some Galilean blood, which was mingled with the sacrifices by Pilate. So there was an animosity between Pilate and the Jewish nations, and because of this shedding of the blood of the Galileans, there was an animosity between Pilate and Herod, who was, of course, in charge of Galilee. Now, it's interesting to note what happened here, because if the Jews had gone to Pilate and said, look, we have got this man here, yes, what's the charge? Well, the charge is that he claimed to be the Son of God. Pilate wouldn't have had 2 minutes for such talk, because the Romans were fed up anyways, not only in Palestine, but throughout the Roman Empire with the Jews. They were troublemakers, and it was usually things to do with their law. For example, when Paul was up in Achaia, brought before Gallio, this is what happened. And when Gallio was the deputy of Achaia, the Jews made insurrection with one accord against Paul and brought him to the judgment seat, saying, this fellow persuadeth men to worship God contrary to the law. As if Gallio could care about that. And when Paul was now about to open his mouth, Gallio said unto the Jews, if it were a matter of wrong or wicked lewdness, O ye Jews, reason would that I should bear with you. But if it be a question of words and names and of your law, look ye to it, for I will be no judge of such matters. Now that was essentially Pilate's attitude. If they'd come to him and said, well, look, we have a blasphemer here, he would have said, well, move on, I'm not interested. It's a question of your law, take it, and you see to it. So what did they do? Well, it's been speculated by people who know a lot more about this than I do that the reason that Pilate was up at 6 o'clock in the morning was that during the time between when the Jews had found him guilty of blasphemy, which was, say, 2 o'clock in the morning and 6 o'clock in the morning, the Jews, Caiaphas had sent messengers to Pilate, telling him to get ready for an early morning rush trial. And I think, as we'll see, they weren't ready for Pilate. So what happened? Well, reconstruction of the Roman trial. Then they led Jesus from Caiaphas unto the hall of judgment, and it was early. And they themselves would not go into the judgment hall, lest they should be defiled. How hypocritical can you get? They wouldn't go into the judgment hall, lest they be defiled because of the coming Passover. But false witnesses, perjury, and so on, that was okay. But we don't want to be defiled by going into the Roman judgment hall. But that they might eat the Passover. Pilate then went out to them and said, what accusation bring ye against this man? Now here is Pilate saying, what's the charge against this man? You've got me up at 6 o'clock in the morning, what's the charge? Now look at what they said. If he were not a malefactor, we would not have delivered him unto thee. Now you know what a malefactor is? It's the opposite of benefactor. Benefactor is a good guy. Malefactor is a bad guy. The charge, they said before Pilate, he's a bad guy, in effect. What's the charge? Well, he's a bad man. So Pilate, and I think the reason they did that was they sort of thought Pilate would agree. Yeah, okay, he's a bad man, well, let's crucify him. That's what they were hoping for. But Pilate said, well, if that's the best you can do, he's a bad guy, take ye and judge him according to your law. Well, the Jews therefore said unto them, it is not lawful for us to put any man to death. And they began to accuse him. Now you see, now they had to adjust their whole approach in midstream. So they found out that Pilate wasn't going to be satisfied when they just said, well, he's a bad guy. Pilate said, well, in effect, move on if that's the best you can do. So then they said, they began to accuse him, saying, we found this fellow perverting the nation and forbidding to give tribute to Caesar, saying that he himself is Christ the King. Now, of course, Jesus never said that you weren't to give tribute to Caesar. He said, render unto Caesar the things that are Caesar, and unto God the things that are God's. And he certainly did not ever say that one shouldn't give tribute to Caesar. But on the second point, where he said that he himself is a king, he perverted the nation by refusing to give tribute to Caesar, saying that he himself is Christ the King. Pilate had to hear that charge, because from the Roman point of view, Jesus was an alien, a non-Roman, but as a Jew living in Palestine,
he owed allegiance to Caesar.
The emperor agreed to the Jewish request to make Palestine a Roman province. The Jewish nation, save some 6,000 Pharisees, expressly gave allegiance to Caesar. Thereafter, any breach of that duty by a Jew was treason. So when they said to him, well, he said he's Christ the King, then Pilate was obligated to listen to that charge, which he then proceeded to do. Then Pilate entered into the judgment hall again and called Jesus and said unto him, art thou the King of the Jews? Jesus answered him, sayest thou this thing of thyself, or did others tell it thee of me? Pilate answered, am I a Jew? Thine own nation and the chief priests have delivered thee unto me. What hast thou done? Now what Jesus said was this. Jesus answered, my kingdom is not of this age or this order. If my kingdom were of this order, then would my servants fight that I should not be delivered to the Jews. But now is my kingdom not from hence. The form of defense that Jesus gave, or the answer that he gave, is called, in legal terms, confession and avoidance. Yes, I confess that I am a king, which is what they say, but not in the form of opposition to Caesar that my accusers are saying. It wasn't to be at this time that his servants were to fight. It wasn't to be at this time that Caesar was to be overthrown by him. And the answer satisfied Pilate. He realized right from the start that whatever this man, and as we'll see as we go on, that he became more and more intrigued by this man, whatever the man before him was, he was not a man ready to get on a white horse and lead a revolt against Caesar. And Pilate understood that right from the start. So, Jesus then continued, to this end, Pilate answered and said unto him, art thou a king then? Jesus answered, thou sayest, I am a king. To this end was I born, and for this cause came I into the world, that I should bear witness unto the truth. Everyone that is of the truth heareth my voice. So Pilate gave, I think, what was an offhand, what is truth anyways? And then he went out again to the Jews and said unto him, I find no fault at all in him. And they were the more fierce, saying, he stirreth up the people throughout all Jewry, beginning from Galilee to this place. When Pilate heard of Galilee, he asked whether the man were a Galilean, and as soon as he knew that he belonged under Herod's jurisdiction, he sent him to Herod, who himself also was at Jerusalem at that time. So Jesus before Herod, when Herod saw Jesus, he was exceeding glad, for he was desirous to see him for a long season, because he had heard many things of him, and he hoped to have some miracle done by him. Then he questioned him with many words, but he answered him nothing, and the chief priests and scribes stood and vehemently accused him. So Herod mocked him, and then he sent him back to Pilate. Why did he send him back to Pilate? I think probably Herod was afraid of Jesus. I don't think he really wanted to help Pilate out of what he could see was becoming a difficult situation. He probably wanted Pilate to take the responsibility for the fate of Jesus, or he may simply have thought that Pilate wanted Jesus returned to him. Well, he gets back before Pilate. I'm sure Pilate was not very glad to see him back. I think he had wished that when he'd sent him to Herod, that that would have been the end of the matter, but it wasn't. Now he has to deal with this man again. And Pilate, when he had called together the chief priests and rulers and the people, said unto them, ye have brought this man unto me as one that perverteth the people, and behold,
I, having examined him before you, have found no fault in this man touching those things which you accuse him, nor yet Herod, or I sent to you unto him, and lo, nothing worthy of death is done unto him. Well, that wasn't, of course, going to pacify the Jews. So he said, I will therefore chastise him and release him. Now, the chastisement that he's talking about there is called the scourging, which was also called the intermediate death. Always rendered the one tortured unconscious. Jesus must have completed his appearance before Pilate in a state of shock. And then the plot begins to thicken a bit, as we will see. The chief priests and elders persuaded the multitude that they should ask Barabbas and destroy Jesus. And they cried all at once, saying, Away with this man, and release unto us Barabbas, who for a certain sedition made in the city, and for murder was cast into prison. Pilate saith unto him, What shall I do then with Jesus, who is called Christ? They said unto him, Let him be crucified. Now there's sort of a great irony here, isn't there, that Barabbas means the son of the father. Bar meaning son of, and father meaning, Abba meaning father. It's sort of a great irony of history that a man by the name of Barabbas, the son of the father, should be freed to allow this man, our Lord, to be put to death. But there's another interesting thing about what the Jews said here, because they wanted him crucified. They didn't want him just put to death. They wanted him crucified. Now, the usual method of dealing with people under Jewish law was stoning, burning, beheading, and strangling. But the Jews wanted him crucified so that he would come under the curse of the law. Remember what the law said, that a man hung on a tree shall be cursed, for he that is hanged is cursed of God. And there's no doubt in my mind that in their hatred of Jesus, they wanted a public demonstration that this man, cursed by God's law and the mode of his death, could not possibly be the Messiah. Stoning, burning, beheading, and strangling would not do. He had to be crucified as a public demonstration that he was cursed of God and could not possibly be the Messiah. Well, what happens? Right in the middle of all this, when Pilate, as we'll see, is beginning to get nervous, his wife sends a message. I'm sure he really needed this in the middle of what he was doing. But his wife sent him a message and said, Look, whatever you're going to do with this man, I've had a dream and have nothing to do with this just man. Now, Pilate, seeing that he could prevail nothing, but rather a tumult was made, he took water and washed his hands before the multitude. We'll comment on that later, saying, I am innocent of the blood of this just man. See ye to it. And then answered all the people, His blood be on us and our children. We'll see why they said that just there shortly. Then Pilate therefore took Jesus and scourged him, and the soldiers plaited a crown of thorns and put it on his head, and they put on a purple robe and said, Hail, King of the Jews! And they smote him with their hands. Pilate therefore went forth again and said unto them, Behold, I bring him forth to you, that ye may know that I find no fault in him. It's interesting to go through the record and find out how many times Pilate, the Roman judge, said that I find no fault in him. Then came he forth wearing the crown of thorns and the purple robe, the thorns, of course, the symbol of the curse, again another irony of history. And Pilate said unto them, Behold the man. When the chief priests, therefore, and elders saw him, they cried out, saying, Crucify him, crucify him. Pilate said unto him, Take ye and crucify him, for I find no fault in him. Again, he said the same thing. He knew, of course, that the Jews would not crucify Jesus. Now, here is where the whole trial turns upside down. The Jews answered him, We have a law. This is the first time they've introduced anything about their law. We have a law, and by our law, he ought to die because he made himself the Son of God. When Pilate therefore heard that saying, now we're getting into a situation where this man who's already impressed him in the 3 hours of the trial, now we have a situation where he finds out that this man before him claimed to be the Son of God. When he heard that saying, he was more afraid and went again into the judgment hall and said unto Jesus, Whence art thou? Pilate was becoming more and more, I believe, afraid of Jesus of Nazareth. There was the Roman superstition and so forth, but he had been impressed with this majestic character before him, and now he found out that he claimed to be the Son of God. But Jesus gave him no answer. Then said Pilate unto him, Speakest thou not unto me? Knowest not thou I have power to crucify thee or power to release thee? Jesus answered, Thou couldst have no power at all against me, except it were given thee from above. Therefore he that delivered unto thee hath the greater sin. Now that must have impressed Pilate too, that reply that you couldn't do anything to me, but it was given from above. And from thenceforth Pilate sought to release him, but the Jews cried out saying, now, and it's recorded by Peter, the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, the God of our fathers, hath glorified his son Jesus, whom you delivered up and denied him in the presence of Pilate, when he was determined to let him go. Now Pilate was determined at this stage of the trial to let Jesus go. And finally the Jews played their final ace card, which turned it around from a trial of Jesus to a trial of Pilate. He wanted to let him go. And here is what the Jews said. And from thenceforth Pilate sought to release him, but the Jews cried out saying, If thou let this man go, thou, Pilate, art not Caesar's friend. And if you're not Caesar's friend, Pilate, your life is worth nothing. Whosoever maketh himself a king speaketh against Caesar. Now it's Pilate who's on trial, because this man, they're saying, claimed to be a rival to Caesar. And if you, Pilate, let a rival to Caesar go, and Caesar finds out about that, your life is worth nothing. When Pilate therefore heard that saying, he brought Jesus forth and sat down in the judgment seat in a place that is called the pavement, but in the Hebrew Gabbatha. And it was the preparation of the Passover about the sixth hour, and he saith unto the Jews, Behold your king. But they cried out, Away with him, away with him, crucify him. Pilate said unto them, Shall I crucify your king? The chief priests answered, We have no king but Caesar, Pilate, and you better not either. Then delivered he therefore unto them to be crucified, and they took Jesus and led him away. So you see that the Roman so-called trial really did not end up in the final analysis being a trial of Jesus at all. It became a trial of Pilate, whether or not he was Caesar's friend, whether or not, as the Jews had all twisted it around, he would allow a man to go free who claimed to be Caesar's friend. So we see what really happened. They started off saying, we've got a bad guy here, and Pilate dismissed that. Then they accused him of perverting the nation, and Pilate examined that charge and said, no, he's not perverting the nation. Then they said, he claimed to be the Son of God, which caused fear in Pilate's mind. And lastly, they said, Pilate, if you let this man go, you are not Caesar's friend. It's very interesting that Pilate never said he was guilty. He never said that. He just finally delivered him to the Jewish people. Now we're running out of time here. I think we'll just make a couple of comments. I'd like to sort of deal with one other subject today, but I just want to sort of make a general comment about this trial. I think there is a bit of a monument to this trial, because they said to Jesus, even as he was hanging on the cross, Ah, thou that destroyest the temple and buildest it in 3 days, save thyself and come down from the cross. Well, as a matter of fact, he did, of course, rebuild the temple of his body in 3 days later. And there's sort of an indirect testimony to what he said, that the literal temple would come down, as he said in Matthew 24. And it's this still visible in Rome, where they actually, the Arch of Titus, where we see the things from the temple being taken out, truly the temple that was there was replaced by one far greater. Now I just want to make a couple of comments about the trial. When Pilate washed his hands, immediately the response of the people was, His blood be upon us and upon our children. In response to his washing the hands, that's what they shouted out. Now, what was really going on there? There was, under the law of Moses, a situation where when they didn't know, they found a dead body but didn't know who the murderer was, they had to go out and behead, the elders of the nearest city had to go out, behead a heifer, and wash their hands over the heifer that is beheaded in the valley and say, our hands have not shed this blood. Now that's what really Pilate was saying. I am not bearing responsibility for the shedding of this man's blood. And they said, as he washed his hands, there was a loud noise. They couldn't hear what he was saying. But as he washed his hands, he was saying to the Jewish people, I am not responsible for this blood. And they knew exactly what he was saying. And they said, well, his blood be upon us. We will accept responsibility. And that is exactly out of the law of Moses here. Now, when you ask why such detail is given about the law, and we start to look into how the parts of the trials fit together in such an exact way and have such a ring of truth about them, the more we look at them, there is no doubt in my mind that the reason that such detail about the trial of Christ was given so that a sincere inquirer after truth, is it really true that 2,000 years ago a man named Jesus died and then rose again? We're going to talk about the resurrection tomorrow. If you're really serious about looking into it, the evidence is there. Those records hang together exactly as they should without explanation. And we're going to take 5 minutes of your time to talk about one other thing, and that is, when Joseph of Arimathea, it's called the last part of what's on this sheet, the rapid death of Jesus, we've got to cover an hour subject in 5 minutes. So we'll do it. But in 1871, a book was written by a medical doctor by the name of William Stroud called The Physical Cause of the Death of Christ, which is a very interesting book to read. And I'm going to give you a summary of a fairly large book in about 2 minutes flat. The thing about crucifixion, it's a horrible way to die, but the interesting thing about crucifixion is that you don't die quickly. And we had all these references here that we're just going to pass over, but generally, people, even who had been badly mauled and tortured before they were crucified, I'll just give you a quick quote here. There are a number of cases in which men were cruelly tortured and then crucified head down, yet surviving 24 hours or more. And he goes on to give many examples, both from history and from more recent history, from ancient history, more recent history, about people who, although they were crucified, lasted on the cross for several hours, or in many cases, days, 2 or 3 days. It was not a death that you died quickly with. Now here's a summary. Although Stroud's work is long out of print and hard to obtain, the reader will find in it many illustrations with full documentation of the fact that crucifixion does not normally bring a quick end to the suffering, even after the condemned man has suffered the most horrible mutilations. Men have been broken on the wheel, stretched on the rack, hung by their thumbs, and even partially burned, and after all this, have been crucified and yet survived for many hours on the cross. Some cases have even been reported from the Far East during World War II. It is not surprising, then, that Pilate found it difficult to believe that Jesus had died so soon. And when they came, Joseph came to Pilate begging the body, was only 3 hours after Jesus had actually been nailed to the cross. He marveled that he was already dead. Now, why was it that Jesus died so quickly? Again, in 2 seconds, we're going to give you a very long story. When we go to look at what happened in the Garden of Gethsemane, where it said that he sweated blood, Stroud gave several references. I'm just going to have to give it to you very quickly. Stroud gives several historical references of other people sweating blood. And it always came about when people were under tremendous stress. The other thing that, in many cases, tremendous stress has caused is a rupture of the heart from emotional stress. And essentially what he detailed in that book is this. We are told in Luke 22:44, that in the Lord's agony in the Garden of Gethsemane, great drops of sweat were seen pouring down his face, with the appearance not of the normal watery fluid which comprises ordinary human sweat in times of stress, but as it were, great drops of blood. And what Stroud suggested, and I think is true, is this, that in the Garden of Gethsemane, I think there may be some justification in supposing that it was in the Garden of Gethsemane that the Lord's heart was ruptured, thereby allowing the blood which leaked from it to accumulate slowly in the pericardial sac. The centurion's spear subsequently punctured this sac and allowed the blood in its separated form to escape via the womb. In Psalm 69:20 we read, "Reproach hath broken my heart," and it's in Psalm 22 as well, "and I am full of heaviness." And the writer goes on to say that if the rest of it's literal, that he looked for comforters and there was none, there's pretty good reason to think that this part, that his heart literally was broken or literally ruptured as a result of emotional stress, is also true. And what is suggested, and I think it is very true, is this, that in the Garden of Gethsemane, our Lord, under the tremendous emotional stress of his final trial, the whole purpose of the creation of God was going to be fulfilled in the next few hours. And the emotional stress just broke him down. In the garden, as he sweated the blood, which is an indication always of tremendous emotional stress, his heart also did rupture. And over the course of the trial into the next day, gradually the blood leaked out into the upper chest cavity here and began to separate. The water would be at the top, of course, and the heavier parts of the blood would be down lower in the body. When he finally was nailed to the cross, he didn't die of crucifixion. He finally died simply of heart failure. What eventually happens is, as the leakage increases in there, finally it just crams in on the heart, and finally the heart just stops because it can no longer move because of the pressure from the built-up fluid. So that when one of the soldiers with a spear came and thrust him in his side, a lot of blood and water came out, which would not be normal. It's commented on in the scripture by John, and it wouldn't be normal to expect that. And he saw and bear record, and his record is true. It's noted in scripture that this blood and water poured out. And when we look at the whole thing put together, he doesn't explain why. He doesn't say, well, he had a heart rupture. When we look in the Psalms, when we look at what happened in Gethsemane, when we look at the fact that Pilate was so surprised he was dead already, and lastly, when we look at when he was thrust in, a lot of water and blood suddenly poured out, which normally wouldn't be there, I think we have an understanding that our Lord finally died of heart rupture brought on by just the extreme emotional stress he was under. Now to conclude, and I don't want to cut into Paul's time, why is such detail given about the trial? Why is such detail given about the manner of the death of Christ? I think the answer is simply this, that if any man, there's all kinds of reasons why people drift away from the truth or are never drawn to it, but I think if any man sincerely wants to sit down with this Bible and answer the question to himself, what do I think of Jesus Christ? I think when he comes to all of it, but particularly the manner of his death and the events relating to the trial, he can read it, he can study it, and finally he can say to himself, this is true.